and salutations, friends, and welcome back to The Arcade. We are your video game podcast back with you here for the week of Friday, February 9th of the year 2018. How's it going, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages? I am Mike the Legend, who's so glad to be back with you after we were away last week. That was my fault. I was busy with work, but the important thing is we are here with you this week, reunited, and it feels so good.
Indeed, and this week I am Dennis, the man who can't wait to see everyone feign interest for the next 2 weeks in speed skating, luge, and Nordic combined, and then forget about them for the next 4 years.
Is that a reference to the Winter Olympics that are just starting as of this week?
Yeah.
The one time of year people actually get to see these sports on any sort of prominent stage and or their TV.
The one time every 4 years.
That's true.
So, yeah, you know, those are all sports that no one cares about. They're all impressive. I can't do any of them.
Certainly not.
But still, Americans, wouldn't you rather be watching football over any of those?
Well, it goes without saying. They would rather watch football over and above everything else.
You know, and also some Americans, basketball over any of those things.
Mm-hmm.
Most Canadians, hockey.
Yeah.
Even some Canadians, curling.
Well, thankfully the Olympics has both of those.
Yes, it does.
And but, it also has luge.
But the thing about that is that we can watch most of these, other, like some of these other sports, anytime.
We can, yes.
Like, there's always football on somewhere in the United States. There's almost always basketball on somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Hockey, there's lots of...
It's happening right now.
It's happening right now, yeah. Also football in Canada as well.
True. Though, I mean, shorter season compared to the NFL, but...
Because we only have 9 teams.
Yes, yes we do. But yeah, the one time of year you actually get to see... Or one time every 4 years, excuse me, you get to see these... sports, and it's not just luge, Nordic combined, and speed skating. It's, there's other ones in there as well, like the biathlon.
Yeah, or the moguls. More.
Moguls, I mean, is visually impressive. In a lot of these sports, it might sound like we're running them down, which...
In a way we kind of are, but in another way, like we're not saying it in a way that means that we think they're not legitimately difficult to do.
There is talent and athleticism required in all of them to get to the stage of the Olympics.
Yeah.
Which we will never in our lives be capable of.
No.
But the general population or the feelings of the general population towards these sports is, hey, the Olympics, these sports. And then as soon as the Olympics are over, nothing. There's no care or concern or regard for these sports.
Like, there's no outcry of people going, you know what, I want to watch, you know, triathlons year-round or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no one normally cares about that. I mean...
Or ski jumping.
You don't normally see ski jumping outside of the Olympics unless it's in some sort of, like, novelty programming sponsored by Red Bull or something.
This is true.
Or cross-country skiing.
No, you're not going to see that any other time of the next 4 years.
No.
That's the only time anyone tunes in with any amount of interest.
Yeah.
I think that's the only time it actually gets on TV.
Yes. I mean, figure skating, you'll see a little bit more often.
Mm-hmm.
But even still, it's like, outside of the Olympics, do people really care about figure skating that much?
Less so, but I think the whole buildup of figure skating is to work towards the Olympics.
Yeah.
Whereas other things, say like curling, they run on their own cycles.
There's lots of different bonspiels, at least in Canada.
Bonspiels and championships and,
yeah.
Very worthwhile titles to play for and challenge for outside of the Olympic cycle.
Yeah, at least in Canada. I don't know how the curling environment is outside of Canada, elsewhere in the world, but it's pretty robust in Canada.
Very robust, very healthy. And certainly there will be a lot of people tuning in to watch that. But hey, mixed doubles curling is a thing this year as well at the Winter Olympics.
Okay.
I understand curling. I don't understand mixed doubles curling. I do not get it.
And hey, bobsled.
That's true.
Like, I was going to say we've all seen Cool Runnings, but maybe we haven't. Maybe there's those... Maybe we have listeners who are too young to remember Cool Runnings.
I pity those people.
Yeah, because, I mean...
It's a good movie.
I was going to say it's not a good movie, but it's a fun movie in that, in a similar way that lots of old Disney movies were not necessarily good movies, but fun movies regardless. Yeah. But yeah, there's really no bobsled outside of the Olympics either.
No, I mean, there's trials in like, you know, world championships, but no one pays the same amount of attention.
Like, you're not going to see the bobsled circuit on TV week after week in the winter time. Like,
ooh, it's the event from Montreal.
Oh, it's the team from Montreal versus the team from whatever. It's like the fastest thing ever because they just, once they're down the hill, it's kind of it, right?
Yes.
So, yeah. I don't know.
I mean, I'm going to watch them. I was watching Moguls earlier today. It's visually impressive to watch. A lot of these things are, except cross-country skiing. That's boring as hell.
Yeah.
Biathlon, I don't understand. Nordic combined, I literally only just found out what the hell that was for the purposes of recording this program.
Yeah.
That is ski jumping and cross-country skiing.
Yes. Put together, which is super weird.
Like, probably not all at once. I'm sure it's like a staggered timed, like combined time event or something. But regardless, that's still an event you could potentially medal in at the Olympics.
Yeah.
If you're of a high enough caliber and can dethrone, like, basically the entire Nordic countries or Scandinavian countries.
Yeah.
Or Germany. Germany just dominates in that stuff too. If not Norway, Germany.
Yeah. But really, honestly, what most Canadians care about is probably just the curling and hockey, and that's probably it.
Yeah,
and they're likely just going to be feigning interest in the other things, going, oh, there's a Canadian competing in, what, luge? Okay. Yeah.
Go for it.
It's like, hey, my daughter went to high school with her. Yeah, okay. we're supporting Cindy. Cool. Okay. She got silver. Isn't that nice?
Well, good for her.
Good.
Yeah.
So now she can become a real estate agent. Okay, perfect. That's what the Winter Olympics, at least from my perspective, is.
You can't go pro really with any of this.
No.
You're like, oh, now she's going to cash in on all those sweet, sweet endorsements?
Yeah, you'll have a park named after you in Transcona if you're a speed skater.
That's right. Well, it's more a large traffic island.
Yeah, yeah. Susanok.
Yes.
But anyways, yeah. So, if you're one of the people who enjoys the Olympics and actually enjoys these events that we're ragging on, please let us know. Reach out to us in any number of different ways that you can reach out to us.
You can reach us in long form, info@thearcadeshow.com, or in short form, on Twitter @thearcadeshow, and on Facebook, facebook.com/thearcadeshow.
Yeah, let us know what the appeal is, because honestly, a lot of these things, it's like, yeah, they're fun to watch for a little bit, but it kind of makes you wonder, how do these sports survive?
That's a good question. Perhaps, is there a European appeal that we're not aware of, that they're really big in a lot of the European countries, and it just something gets lost in translation across the ocean?
And do semi-regular, like, televised events happen for some of these things elsewhere in the world? Kind of like strongman competitions or something? Like, I don't know. Maybe.
Do they happen outside of the build-up to the Olympics?
Yes.
So, like, next year, are you going to be watching the luge championships? Is that a thing? Or do they only happen, like, the year or two preceding an Olympic event? Because that's really when the trials and everything, qualification cycle starts to happen.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah, so Olympics, it's a thing that's happening. But if you're taking time off from, or time out from watching the Olympics and have joined us, we thank you for that. And we do apologize again for being away last week. It's been kind of a wonky schedules for us so far this year. But between illness, you know, flus and work and whatnot, that's life.
Sure is.
But we are back this week. And we're playing a bit of catch-up, and by bit, I mean a lot.
We're playing a lot of catch-up, because a lot of stuff happened in the last couple of weeks.
Yes, and I was entirely engrossed in my work, and it wasn't really until, say, last weekend I started to dig in earnest to find out what happened, and kind of realized quite quickly, goddamn, just the week I'm not paying attention, not really keeping my ear to the ground, a whole lot happened. Not everything, but a whole lot happened. And we'll start with the largest single news-making entity from the past several days, which was Nintendo.
Yes, in many ways, arguably, for almost the last year, they've kind of, you know, won back the gaming world with the Switch and Zelda, Mario Odyssey, and all that other fun stuff. But they keep making news, and they keep doing things that have people go, huh, interesting, cool.
Seemingly, it's a more so than what we saw with the Wii. The Wii has become more of a flash in the pan and looks more and more like a flash in the pan as the Switch continues to have such great success.
Yeah, I mean, where the Wii people were super excited for a bit for what ultimately turned out to be a gimmick, the Switch actually keep, like, they have their gimmicks as well, but they keep it reined in, and they also recognize, well, the gimmicks aren't for everybody, and we have to deliver on good games, so we also have those.
This is true, and even then, the gimmick, whatever gimmicks there are for the Switch, feel more robust, more diverse, like you can do more with it, and not quite the one-trick pony that the Wii was.
No, like, I mean, it has everything that the Wii did have, because, I mean, the weird, like, paddle things, I don't know what exactly their name is.
Oh, the Joy-Cons?
The Joy-Con, that's what it was. The Joy-Cons for the Switch, they're essentially, like, more robust versions of the Wiimote, but they're way more robust because they actually have HD rumble, which they showed what that meant with Labo, and recently I read that actually there's an infrared camera, which can, is pretty crazy in one of them, that can do, like, you know, basically like that, like, heat vision kind of thing that you'll see, like, people, like, walking through the dark to be like, oh, look at this. And we'll, like, you know, like the military kind of thing that you'll often see, or like your Predator.
Yes.
Like Predator is like the closest thing I can think of, that type of imagery apparently with it, which is how they're able to, you know, gauge distance and stuff for that one game. I think it was 1-2 Switch.
Okay, yes, yeah.
Like that has been the only game really so far that uses it, but Labo uses it as well, and maybe other things. But yeah, ultimately these are just kind of gimmicky things, but they are more robust gimmicky things, but they're not the prime selling focus of the Switch.
They aren't, and they've been very underutilized through the first year of the Switch as well.
Which is a good sign in a lot of people's minds as well, because it's Nintendo reining their typical instincts in a bit, because, you know, the typical Nintendo instinct seems to be, we have these non-conventional things, let's just show everyone how non-conventional we are, whereas, like, a lot of people say, yeah, that's great, except I prefer conventional stuff, so maybe I won't buy a Nintendo thing.
Exactly, and I think that's the lesson learned from the Wii, is that they're not forcing these things down consumers' throats or developers' throats.
I'd say even further with the Wii U. Because the Wii U, well, it was like kind of that with the that screen controller that was ultimately useless in, you know, and like almost like a half-baked version of what the Switch ended up being. But, yeah, they learned from that. They took the best parts from it, the ones that they figured out that they could salvage, and then ended up moving forward. And as a result, they've done really gangbusters in the last 10 months, 11 months since the Switch was released.
It's true, and we've spoken of the sales numbers that Nintendo has released many times on this program before, because they've been so impressive, and it was at the end of January that Nintendo held a an earnings report with investors and business media outlets, and it was during that conference call with everyone, as they announced their earnings, that they revealed that in very short order, comparatively short order, the Nintendo Switch has now officially surpassed the lifetime sales of the Wii U.
Yeah.
So the previous Nintendo console has now been outpaced by the Nintendo Switch, which looked like it was going to happen, but it happened in less than a year of being on the market for the Switch.
Yeah, so the Switch came out in March, and as of January 31st, about 14.87 million Switches. Well, sorry, as of the end of December of 2017, about 14.87 million Switches were sold.
And compare that to the lifetime hardware sales of the Wii U, which stand at 13.56 million units. So, it hasn't just surpassed, it's, substantively surpassed the lifetime sales of the Wii U.
Yes, it's crossed it by a million so far, and it doesn't really seem like it's slowing down.
No, not at all. And whatever hiccups there were with supply and availability in the first couple weeks or months of the Switch being on the market seem to have been rectified, yet the device is still selling gangbusters. So how many more would have been sold in those initial periods if stock was available? I guess we don't know, and it's hard to tell because there's still more demand.
Yeah.
There's still ever more demand for the device. Now, that is the Wii U that has been outsold, and we know that is the weakest system that Nintendo has ever released in terms of sales for their home console lineup. Now, let's compare the Switch and its 14.87 million units sold to some other Nintendo consoles that have come out previously, and there's still some room before it catches the next closest competitor, which I think would be the GameCube in terms of Nintendo's home consoles for that.
Yeah, so the lifetime sales of the GameCube was 21.74 million.
Yes, so it could conceivably surpass the GameCube by the end of this year.
Yeah. Now the question is, will it surpass the Wii? Not right away.
No.
It won't, but it'll probably at least match the Wii in its lifetime sales. And remember, the Wii sold an impressive 101.63 million units. So.
In its lifetime.
In its lifetime. Not like its first year or anything, that would be insane, but in its lifetime, over 100 million units. That's a hell of a lot of units moved. But if the Switch is planned, I read somewhere, now don't quote me on this, but I read somewhere that Nintendo says that they're planning on supporting the Switch for 7 years. So if they're doing that, like if the Switch is going to be out on the shelves conceivably for 7 years, if they're doing 14 million a year, they could possibly do it.
It's true. And remember, a lot of the sales of the Wii came in the first three and a half to 4 years of being on the marketplace.
Yeah.
When it was just selling like hotcakes, and then it quickly dwindled after that.
And then
almost fell off a cliff.
I mean, and unlike, you know, the Wii days and unlike any other previous days, it seems like Nintendo's finally figured out how to keep a hype train going.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Because they started out super strong out of the gate with really just one game, but really the game that everyone wanted to play, Breath of the Wild. Later on, like, give it a couple months, released the next game that everyone wanted to play, Mario Odyssey. Give it a few months. Now they're just, like, dropping crazy things like Labo on people, having people go, oh, wait a minute. Now I see the appeal of, like, this non-game weird stuff. Okay. So it's like a multi-purpose thing. I get it in this context now. Okay.
Now that you have the substantive, the worthwhile and fulfilling gaming experience with Breath of the Wild, with Mario Odyssey, now Nintendo can diverge into the crazy crap.
Yeah, now they can start Nintendoing it up. But
as opposed to, say, the Wii, where that was what they did right off the hop.
Yeah. But it doesn't... I wouldn't count out the good, solid games yet either. I mean, at this point, if two of their main AAA titles, like... that have been released have been rated almost 10 out of 10, 5 out of 5, whatever, across the board games. Is Nintendo setting themselves up for, like, maybe this being their best gaming generation in maybe since the Super Nintendo?
The initial indicators are looking that way. We'll see what happens with Metroid Prime 4, a standalone Pokemon game, standalone mainline, excuse me, Pokemon game, because those are still in the pipeline, and then whatever else there is.
Yeah.
Like a new Mario Kart.
Yes.
A brand new.
Yes.
Mario Kart.
I was even thinking, maybe a new Mario Party.
Yeah.
If ever there was a system that it would be great on, this would be it.
Given the ability to have the two Joy-Cons right there.
And
instant
also,
multiplayer experience.
And also, with the proliferation of the internet since, like, you know, a couple of generations ago, well, really, since the N64 and GameCube, when the best Mario Party games were released, I mean, I'm sure the older we all got, like, those of us who remember the old Mario Party games, who maybe can't get to hang out with their friends, you know, like we used to, but, like, get online for an hour or so and just, like, you know, get in the headset, whatever kind of thing, like, mm-hmm. playing a Mario Party game, like, that would be pretty fun, I think.
It would be, and Nintendo has done more for the online experience now than what they used to back in the day. So yeah. that could certainly be a possibility. But we'll see how that pans out. Just to compare the Switch to some other successful Nintendo consoles, just for reference sake, so you can look and sound smart at your next dinner party. Of course, the Nintendo Wii, their best-selling unit, as we said, with over 100 million units. The Nintendo 64 sold 32.93 million units in its lifetime. The Super Nintendo sold 49.1 million, and the NES, which started this whole new generation of video gaming at home, 61.91 million units. So it's entirely conceivable that the Switch surpasses the first three Nintendo consoles.
Yeah, it is.
The first four, I should say. Excuse me.
Yeah, but something that's not going to surpass those, I think, mostly due to supply issues. Though if they had ample supply, it could have been close, was the SNES Classic.
Which came out at the end of September and has seen more units shipped of it than the NES Classic Edition, which came out 2 years ago.
Yep.
And has been continually sold out everywhere.
Yes. And what that meant was that, as of January 31st, we're going back a little bit in time here because, you know, we're catching up a bit.
Yeah, this is still from the Nintendo earnings report.
But as of January 31st, the SNES Classic reached 4 million units sold worldwide.
And it came out only at the end of September, like right at the end of September. So it had October, November, December, and then a little bit of January to be counted as for sales.
Yeah, so a million units a month.
This is just a rinky-dink little $90 micro-console device.
Yeah, with 21 games on it.
Yes.
But, you know, there's enough of us who remember the nostalgia and like a bunch of these games and all that stuff.
And also the consumer proposition of it's cheaper than trying to buy all these old games individually, too.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's that. Going forward as well, but 4 million, a very impressive number. The profit margin has got to be ridiculous on that, considering.
Oh, yeah, it's probably just, its internals are probably just a Raspberry Pi, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And those are what, $30?
And how much really did they have to do to alter it, or update it from the NES software?
I actually understand that it's actually the exact same hardware as the NES Classic.
That does not surprise me.
And they probably just put a skin over top of whatever ROM loading system that they had for the first one. So, not a lot of work there.
No.
And just toss a little bit of heart, like software on the thing, put it in its cutesy little case and ship it out. Like, they're probably getting, the cost of the units is probably like 10, 15 bucks each. And they're selling them for 100. Like, that's pure money.
That's a ridiculous amount of money. That's 4 million units sold, again, of the SNES Classic Edition. A device which has seen supply problems. Now, there was a lot more at launch. A lot more people came away satisfied after launch day than with the NES Classic Edition. However, if you've tried to find one since, you've had an absolute bitch of a time to do so.
Absolutely.
Stores getting in maybe 5 every week and then selling out instantly. A couple weeks ago, back in December, I told the story of just happening across one when I was in a store that had not gotten any in since the launch day in September and only got 2. And I just happened to be there, right place at the right time, an hour after they were put on the shelf. So I, of course, picked one up.
Yeah.
But compare that to the NES Classic Edition, which sold 2.3 million units prior to its discontinuation. How many more units of these would be sold if there weren't supply problems? I wonder if the SNES Classic Edition would see 10 million units sold. That might seem like a high number, but I don't know. If that's the sell-through on very limited quantity, I would imagine 10 million is not entirely ridiculous.
I want to say that it might have actually sold as well as the Switch.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
That's just my gut feeling, just given the crazy fervor for the SNES Classic and the NES Classic. I feel like the NES Classic would have done as well.
True, too.
If there was enough to go around.
Which there wasn't. Nintendo says that more NES Classic Editions will come out this year, but they have not announced any plans for that at all.
No. No release date, no anything. Nothing.
No. But we'll keep you apprised as we learn more about that. And of course, this year we expect to see the N64 Classic Edition.
Yeah.
With probably a Mario Party game or two on there.
Yep, probably Mario Kart 64, probably Ocarina of Time, possibly Majora's Mask, definitely Mario 64.
Certainly, Donkey Kong 64.
Maybe.
Well, I'd imagine it would be. And then you get into the question of the rare games. Will Nintendo strike a licensing deal with Microsoft to have those on there? Because how could you have an N64 Classic Edition without GoldenEye, without Perfect Dark? Without Banjo-Kazooie.
Yeah. GoldenEye for sure would have to be on there. That was maybe the definitive game of the N64. But we're digressing too much.
We are. But those classic editions, the N64 one when it comes out this year, the SNES Classic Edition, the NES Classic Edition, those are all licenses to print money, as the Switch has been. And because of all that, Nintendo, during its earnings report, letting news out of its very robust profits and earnings. It's a very healthy company. Before, if you think, say, maybe about 3-4 years ago, at the tail end of the Wii U life cycle, they were losing money.
Yeah, there were stories of the executives having to take pay cuts just to kind of, like, help keep the lights on, keep things afloat, get them through the dark time. But according to the financial report, which came out at the end of last month, over the 9 months ending December 31st, 2017, sales increased by 175.5% year over year to 857 billion yen, which approximates $7.87 billion US dollars, while profits rose by 30% to 135 billion yen, which is 1.23 billion US during the same period. So 1.23 billion profits. Pure profits.
Yes.
Over a 9 month period.
And the sale they did of the Seattle Mariners a couple years ago, that's already cycled through. That's not the cash they got from that. That's
no.
In process. This is straight Switch sales, straight game sales, straight SNES Classic Edition sales.
Yeah.
And also 3DS sales. Because it's still selling. Its sales are decreasing a bit, but still, for the 9 month period, Nintendo reported that 3DS hardware sales were down 9% year over year to 5.86 million units, while also the software sales on the 3DS side were down 33% to 31.25 million units. However, it still sold almost 6 million units in 9 months.
Yeah.
When there's a brand new console that can go on with you everywhere, much like the 3DS.
Yeah. But the one big question I think that everyone's been wondering about the Switch in particular is, when is the online service going to happen?
And Nintendo has really said precious little about that. Up until last week.
Yeah, and last week they finally shed a little bit more light on the premium online service.
Yeah, they pulled back, pulled back the curtain, halfway?
Yeah, and they revealed the name, Nintendo Switch Online, which is the long kind of touted, not really straight up talked about, but sort of hinted at, paid online subscription service that they've kind of dropped tiny bits of information about here and there, that it's going to be launching in September of 2018. So it's not right away, but it's also not too far off.
No, it's something to look forward to. I guess the benefit of announcing it now is that the news is out there, and it, you know, can't be said that they're withholding information. It's out there, but you're going to forget about it. And this gives them time to bring out more details in the intervening months. Price points, $3.99 US for a single month, $7.99 for 3 months, $19.99 for a full year. Those are all US dollars, but $20 US for an entire year.
Yeah, and that's not bad considering what we've revealed so far, or what has not we've revealed, but what Nintendo's revealed so far about this upcoming Nintendo Switch Online. So far we know that you'll be able to play online and use features like voice chat, which you've been able to get for free up until this point, but that's going away. But when it goes away, you're going to be gaining access to a classic game selection as well that features vintage titles like Super Mario Brothers 3, Balloon Fight, Dr. Mario, and probably everything else you can possibly think of on the NES at some point.
And they haven't clarified their classic games approach to the online service yet.
No.
I did read one report where it said that they'd give you like one or two games free for just a month, and then as when the calendar rolls over, those games go away, and you get like one or two classic games free to play. I think everyone would much prefer it to be some kind of Netflix-type service.
Yeah.
Would just give us the whole vault.
Yeah, give us as much as you can, and I'd gladly pay $20 a year for that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's cool. Like, I don't care about owning these games. Like, as long as they're available for me to play, yeah, I'll jump into anything like that. I mean,
pick up and play anytime.
Like, otherwise, like, ROMs are around. Nintendo has to know that. Nintendo has to know how easy it is to get complete ROM sets for every classic system.
In minutes.
In, like, minutes, set up, like, an emulator super easily.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'll gladly pay $20 a year. Like, that feels like a fair price for something that, essentially, they're not making money on anyways.
No, they aren't. And this is software. They have emulation files. This is all stuff they have kicking around.
Yeah. It's just, like, you know, peace of mind money I'd gladly pay that you might as well, like, we're going to be doing it anyways, or we have been doing it anyways. You might as well make a bit of money off of us. We'll pay it.
And that has been demonstrated, that there is a demand for nostalgia for these classic games with the classic editions.
It's also Netflix proved that, like, while people will pirate things, people will pay for things as long as it's a fair price. It's like, if they feel like they're getting value for something, yeah, like, I don't care about owning a million movies, but if I have a million movies available to me to watch whenever I want for $10 a month, sure. Yeah, I'll pay that. Why not?
Now, an entire year for $20 US, compare that to what, the $60, if not more, you pay for the Xbox Gold or Xbox Live Gold, and what's the PlayStation Network?
PlayStation Plus.
A PlayStation Plus, was that run you like $50, $60 a year?
It's about $70 a year, yeah.
$70 a year.
Well, Canadian anyways, but yes. I pay that as well. I mean, it pays off. You get tons of free games with it, but, well, free games in quotation marks, but yeah. I don't know. Hopefully it's a Netflix style thing.
Yeah.
So hopefully Nintendo's listening to this podcast and they're going, you know,
during
what?
Their meetings.
During their meetings. Just, oh, what does the arcade have to say?
We are the pulse of this generation.
As old millennials, we can speak for all of millennials, but,
We're a good representation, a good cross-section of people.
Yes.
But in addition to that, Nintendo also earned a bunch of money comparatively over year-on-year in their smartphone business. And just last December, revealed and launched the latest title for that, the Animal Crossing game. And it seems like between Miitomo and Super Mario Run, they may have figured things out a bit more. As also during that earnings report, they announced that the next title to come from the company that they will release to smartphone platforms is Mario Kart Tour.
Let's not forget Animal Crossing as well, Mobile Camp, but.
Yes. Well, I did touch on that at first, Pocket Camp.
Yeah, Pocket Camp.
But between, well, Miitomo and Mario Run were the first two, like, trial balloons put out there, and
yeah,
were clearly Nintendo just working out the kinks and figuring things out.
Yeah, then it seems like they hit full force with Pocket Camp, and now they're going to keep going with another honestly, frankly, a little bit surprising, but not bad game to add to the mobile pantheon, which is Mario Kart Tour.
Yes, and that's about all we know of the game. It's coming out sometime in the next fiscal year, so between April of this year and March of next year.
Yes.
So that pins it down nicely.
Yeah.
Any day now.
Any day now.
Any day now, next month.
Yeah. But,
so that, I'm sure, will be popular, and also just a new way for you to get your ass handed to you by some 10-year-old across the ocean.
Yeah, because that's what we all like to have happen to us while playing video games. Just basically be told how old we are and how young they are and how much better their reflexes are than yours and all that fun stuff.
Hey, I get that with my 6-year-old now who plays Mario Kart Wii. He's now surpassing the adults in his life.
Your 6-year-old nephew?
Yes, my 6-year-old nephew. Mario Kart, he's mastered drifting, and then there's old man Uncle Mike who hasn't mastered drifting because we didn't have drifting coming up playing Mario Karts, and so...
I mean, we sort of did, but it was always kind of hinky and you never really needed it.
And now there's ways to do it and you get a boost out of it, and that's really how you find success in Mario Kart games now, and I haven't gotten a handle on it, and he has, and he can just smoke people.
Yeah.
And so, of course, that's what he wants to play, because he can win, and Uncle Mike's like, no, it's okay. Let's play something else. Hey, let's play Dr. Mario.
Yes.
I feel like making you cry. but other Nintendo news that has come out, a big deal that was hinted at, rumored at, spoken about in whispers and hushed tones last November was the plans for Nintendo to make a new Mario animated movie. Those were officially confirmed as Nintendo sent out a press release announcing the deal they signed with Illumination Entertainment, that being the animation studio behind the Minions movie, Despicable Me, Secret Life of Pets. You've seen their work. It's made tons of money, and it's also a movie going to be done in partnership with Universal Pictures. And an interesting aspect of this is not just that Shigeru Miyamoto is going to be an executive producer on this movie, so Nintendo will have representation at the table all through the creative process, much unlike Super Mario Brothers movie of many years ago.
Yeah, which, well, we all remember how that turned out.
Yeah, so when two of the most renowned actors of, you know, the 90s and into the 2000s, both regarded as the worst job of their career, that says something.
There were three legendary, two legendary actors and John Leguizamo in that movie. Yet it turned out what it was.
Yep.
Yeah. It did.
But, not only will they have Shigeru Miyamoto at the table to not have that happen, but Nintendo is actually co-financing this movie. I guess as a means of ensuring that
An equal say.
They have an equal say. No one's going to take creative liberties with this the same way as happened with the Super Mario Brothers movie from 1993. So Nintendo and Universal are paying for it. Universal will get distribution rights. Nintendo will, of course, get a share of the profits, which should be substantive. I'd imagine this will make a couple hundred million, unless they really screw the pooch on it. And will cost a bit to make, but no window for a release date has been announced yet. The creative process is still just starting on this. They still have to hire screenwriters, directors, voice cast. There's many, many, many months of work to go on this.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's going to be interesting when it comes out, and I look forward to it. I think the animation style is going to be very appropriate between what Illumination does and really the look of Nintendo games now.
Yeah, I mean, as much as I just hate what Minions have become in the greater spectrum of pop culture, the first couple Despicable Me movies were pretty good. And I mean, they've got that whole cartoony style down, and I'm sure it would just be a matter of them to say, hey Nintendo, can you give us your 3D models for Mario from Mario Odyssey? Great, thanks. And then that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. So the real trick will be crafting a story.
Yeah. Which I'm waiting for a good Mario thing. We've never really seen Mario work properly outside of the video game realm.
That's true.
It's never really... He's kind of... Here's the problem, which I'm not convinced that this is going to actually be... Like, I'm sure it'll look good. I'm sure it'll be, like, put together well, no matter what it is. But I'm not convinced yet that they can make a proper Mario movie in the same way that, like, they probably couldn't make a good Legend of Zelda movie. Because Mario sort of is, like, the non-talking... almost no personality avatar that's supposed to, he represents you in the world. Mm-hmm. So he can be, his attitude can be whatever you want his attitude to be because it's kind of a blank slate. And however you'd react is like, you can put a lot of yourself into that, the shoes of the character by doing that. Movies don't really work that way.
No, there's no personality there. There's nothing to draw interest from an audience.
Yeah, and every time they've tried to put a personality on Mario, it's just seemed kind of weird. Like, remember the Super Mario Brothers Super Show?
I mean, which one, the cartoon portion or the live action segments?
Yeah, let's just say both, or the kind of later Super Mario World cartoon, mm-hmm. where Mario was just like a gruff Italian, like American plumber from clearly like a New York guy, but like, it always just seemed weird. It's like, why did they make Mario like this? He's just kind of like, he's just that side-scrolling character I control. Like, why is he all gruff and like, stuff like that? And then later on, it's like, Bob Hoskins and mm-hmm. just basically do a weird abstract take on Mario. And
how do you develop motivation and drive in a story for this character that just doesn't come off as, you know, overly simplistic?
Yeah.
Because Mario is a very simple character.
Yeah. He's literally just a representation, like a blank representation of you in that world. Mm-hmm. That's all Mario basically ever needs to be in a video game.
That's quite the challenge for the screenwriters of this movie.
I would actually like if they made Mario silent the whole time.
Ooh.
And just basically had people talking around him and have, like, almost like a Silent Bob kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That could work.
Would you then have, say, a character like Luigi talk as well?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. It's a unique idea. It's a bold idea. I don't know if they would go with it, but...
I don't know. I mean, that's the only way I could possibly see it working. But, again, we have a ways to wait for this,
oh, yes.
So we'll see what happens when it comes out, and maybe expect our review, if and when we see it, whenever it comes out, that is.
Oh, yes. I certainly... would be interested to see it. And then to contrast it with the Bob Hoskins movie from 1993.
Yeah, Bob Hoskins, Dennis Hopper, John Leguizamo.
If it comes out in 5 years' time in 2023, perfectly 30 years after the first one,
yep,
I'm going to feel like a really old man.
Same. I remember renting that movie when I was a kid. I was super excited for it. And then it completely failed to impress me. And I was really disappointed.
But let's move on from speaking about things that might be disappointment. One last Nintendo topic we'll touch on that we kind of discussed earlier in terms of things to get excited about on the Switch for this year, Labo. We spoke about it the last time we did a program when Nintendo just caught everybody off guard and revealed it. Now there was a press event in New York, and Jason Schreier was one of the attendees at that event, and reported on a very interesting detail about Labo that we did not know previously. Labo is a very DIY, build-it-yourself construction-type toy, but what it also contains, too, apparently, is the ability to, in a way, program and code your own toys in the software.
Yeah, so there's this feature called ToyCon Garage, which lets you build... which lets you use simple quote-unquote building blocks to let you program a device. They're basically like, to overly simplify it, they're like if-then statements, found in programming, but if you don't know programming at all, basically, you can have an if statement, which where you say, if this condition is met, then do this thing. Mm-hmm. So... they have these building blocks that let you do that. You open up a program, select from a number of blocks based on input options for your Switch controllers. Then you connect them to the other blocks based on output options. So the example they give is you connect the left Switch controller's up button to the right Switch controller's vibration feature, so whenever you press up on the left Joy-Con, the right Joy-Con will buzz. And this is how Labo users will be able to expand beyond the 6 types of cardboard creations, which are included in the variety set, or the 1 in the robot set. So instead of, you know, just basically, to continue the Lego analog we sort of developed, or like the Lego analogy we developed a couple weeks ago, this is basically like, instead of, like once you've built your crazy spaceship, now you can tear it apart and use all the pieces to put something new and original together.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of do whatever you want with it. So, yeah.
And I think that even strengthens the appeal of this to parents of older kids.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a smart toy, a more intelligence-based toy, and also has appeal for, I guess, STEM, too, because a lot of people are wanting to get themselves or their children involved in STEM, the STEM field, and get them coding and more involved in the building blocks of computers earlier on, building or computers and software earlier on.
Yeah.
To get them into technology, IT fields.
Or at the very least, like if you don't get them into a technology field, at least set them up to just kind of exist in this technology focused world now, because honestly, these concepts shouldn't just be like, the basic logic concepts like if, then, shouldn't just be reserved for developers and programmers. Like, it kind of helps with critical thinking. It kind of helps you, you know, work through problems on your own before having to immediately just basically give up and go, I can't do this. It kind of fills you with more self-confidence and stuff. So, really, like, this is great.
It is, and also too, yeah, the sets might seem limited, but if you can build your own stuff out of the cardboard sets or whatever other cardboard you have kicking around, doesn't have to be the sheets they supply you with.
No.
I mean, I'm not going to say the sky's a limit, but there's a lot more you can do there.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially with the big contraption of the robot set.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Sure is.
So what are some people going to build? Also, some parents, some like home hackers, some home DIYers and enthusiasts. What are they going to build?
Yeah. And what kind of plans are we going to see turn up on the internet for various crazy things?
This is going to be a very robust community on the internet when it comes out and people really start digging into it in earnest.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
So that's going to be something to look forward to, but we'll look back for a minute to last weekend. The last big hurrah for the NFL season was Super Bowl 52 from US Bank Stadium in Minneapolis. And if we had done a program last week, we would have spoken about the prediction for the Super Bowl, for the big game from EA Sports and Madden 18, where they simulate one game with as accurate a roster and conditions as they can possibly manifest. Instead, we'll just recap the prediction versus the reality.
Yeah.
And it turns out this year, just everything was wrong. Just, it was not a good year for the Madden 18 prediction.
No, it completely fell apart.
According to the prediction, it would have been the Patriots who defeated the Eagles 24-20. Instead, it was the Eagles besting the Patriots by a score of 41-33. So right there are two facts, winner and final score, totally wrong.
Yep.
The sim also said that Tom Brady, star quarterback of the Patriots, would be the Super Bowl MVP. He wasn't. That went to Eagles quarterback Nick Foles. And just a lot of different things we can break down from the simulation versus reality. We won't go into it all, but there were some things that were just totally wrong. Some things that were like kind of on the right path, but ended up still being wrong. Like, the simulation said that Tom Brady would throw an interception that led to an Alshon Jeffrey touchdown. He didn't. And in fact, Tom Brady did not throw an interception in the game. He was sacked. Although the simulation said that Chris Long, who played on the Patriots and won a Super Bowl with them last year, would be the one to sack Tom Brady. It turns out no, Tom Brady was only sacked once. That was in the latter part of the fourth quarter by defensive end Brandon Graham. So that was wrong as well. The simulation said that Rob Gronkowski, star tight end for the Patriots, would lead all receivers in the game with 4 catches and over 100 yards receiving and 1 touchdown. That was wrong. It was Danny Amendola, also of the Patriots, led everyone with 8 catches for 152 yards, but no touchdowns. And there's just not really a lot of success for the simulation this year.
No, it was quite off. But, you know, still, it's, I mean, that skews its record a little bit, but it's still been pretty accurate over the last, what, 12 years?
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds about right to me. I think it's better than 500.
Yeah. It's still a better source of potentially what you want to use if you're going to make a bet than, let's say, any sort of, you know, TV pundits or, I don't know how prevalent they are anymore, but I always think of the Simpsons scene where Homer's going through the TV stations and he's seeing all like the different novelty, you know,
prognosticators
and this is my lock of the week. And they have a giant lock on the thing. And then he calls the coaches hotline and he just wastes all his money because they're talking super slow, talking about wind speed and stuff. But like, no, this is still probably going to be your best bet if you want to go with it, but.
And when Super Bowl time rolls around too, you start to notice all the little quirky stories that pop up, be it on the news, be it on YouTube or whatever source of information you get things from, of this dolphin at whatever aquarium or zoo predicted this team to win the Super Bowl, where like the trainer just tossed out one football for each team and the dolphin swam to one of them first or
yeah,
things of that nature.
Yeah.
Or like an octopus. I think there was one year like an octopus was a fairly accurate prognosticator for no rhyme nor reason other than just it had a better than 50-50 record.
Yeah. But yeah, this at the very least has a bunch, like a whole lot more data points involved. And I mean, it is a video game, but honestly, video games are pretty sophisticated these days.
I wonder if anyone on the dev team or anyone who put the simulation together then uses this information to go make wagers.
Oh, like, I don't doubt it.
And if it's wrong, does, like, the lead developer just come in, talk to the team on Monday morning, be like, so, who wants to explain why I lost all my life savings?
It's like, because you're an idiot. Well, you're fired, but thanks for the wake-up call. I slept in my car last night.
I'm too ashamed to go home.
My wife left me.
So, like, do they then use that as a source and motivation to be like, all right, next year we'll get them. It's going to be even more accurate next year.
Yes.
Or the team's just like, we don't care. It's a fun thing. Gets us press attention.
Yeah. I think it's probably more the latter. But
or there's some really hardcore gambling addicts.
Just everyone at EA. All right. I went hard on black and crapped out. Sorry, everyone. No, there's no Christmas this year. I was like, whoa, that got really dark. But speaking of gambling, one of the biggest things that we were talking about last year, I know we're not doing a look back, but Battlefront 2 was sort of like when loot boxes came to a head.
Yeah, that was the big flashpoint. Everything had kind of been percolating and sparking, but that was the big flare up of people's rage and gamers' rage and anger. And fear over loot boxes, microtransactions. People had finally said, you know what, this is enough. This is stupid. And the uproar was such that EA kind of had to walk that back and took microtransactions out of Battlefront 2.
Yeah.
And people thought, okay, they'd be gone for good. But no, EA in an earnings report this week, or actually last week, excuse me, said that microtransactions will come back in the next few months. That according to EA's finance chief, Blake Jorgensen, he did go on to say, quote, we'll do it when we think it's ready. And they're doing that because the sales of Battlefront 2 were off compared to the company's projections.
Yeah, they were projecting that they needed to sell 10 million copies of the game, and they only sold 7 million, which, you know, leaves a 3 million copy gap, which sounds insane to say. But as a result, they need to make that money back somehow.
Yeah.
/ make that money.
Yeah.
They need to.
Well, I mean, they are a publicly traded company. So if you're not trying to make money for your shareholders, what are you doing?
Fair enough, I guess.
So look for microtransactions to come back. Also, in the next couple months, I'm sure they're figuring that'll be enough time since the uproar initially flared up and it'll have died down and dissipated by then.
Yeah.
We'll see. It all depends on the approach they take. Is it purely cosmetic items? Is it game items that will actually affect gameplay? Are the odds disclosed?
Yeah, but moving from the battlefront to the battlefield.
you, Mr. Smooth Man.
Yes, yeah, smooth transitions. Me this week, EA has confirmed that there will be a new Battlefield game for 2018, called Anthem. It's officially coming out, Anthem is officially coming out in 2019. That's a different thing, but,
It was initially believed that Anthem would come out this fall, at least that was the belief when EA showed it off at last year's E3 conference, but they've pushed it back. It's delayed until 2019, but EA is not really saying it's a delay. In fact, Blake Jorgensen, when he spoke about this to the Wall Street Journal, said, it's not a delay. People are trying to create a story. But they pegged 2018 as a release when they showed it off in 2017, and now it's not coming out in 2018, it's coming out 2019. So how's that not a delay?
It's almost like he's trying to use that weird Trump fake news thing. It's like, we have proof of you saying this. Oh, no, fake news.
No, I didn't say that.
It's like, well, if the president can get away with it, I guess anyone can, then fine. But,
So with it being pushed, and that's a big release, to potentially start an entirely new franchise. For EA and I believe BioWare, that they wanted to move it to 2019. The reason being, 2018 is going to be kind of a cluster of major releases, so they wanted to get it to where there's less major releases, so it has a better chance of flourishing. And just so they still have something to come out in the fall of 2018, a new Battlefield game will come out this year for all the major platforms.
Yes, in October.
Yes, no details on what it is, its setting, but Battlefield 1 did quite well for the company and was well received both critically and commercially, so there's that to look forward to. But we say EA is moving games such as Anthem out of the fall because it's going to get cluttered, and one of those cluttering titles that forced EA's hand is the fact that Rockstar Games now has a solid release date for Red Dead Redemption 2.
Yes, and everyone can kind of, well, it's kind of not really worth competing against it because that's one of those titles that everyone is going to buy.
It is a 500-pound gorilla. It's just going to clobber everything else. Red Dead Redemption 2, couple of delays. I think this is the second or third one it got, but regardless, it is now pegged. It is written in stone or bloodstone for a release on October 26th on your PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. It was initially slated for a fall 2017 release. That got delayed for more time for Spit and Polish. It was thought to come out in 2018 or spring 2018. That has now been pushed back for yet more Spit and Polish, but by God, at least with Rockstar Games, you can see the Spit and Polish.
Yes. When they say we need to push this back for to make it better, you are definitely going to see a good game at the end of it.
That's the benefit of a 4 to 5 year dev cycle.
Yeah.
It justifies the cost. It's an expensive title.
Yeah, but they make their money back, and they also don't skimp, and they also never really fail to impress critics and fans.
No, you are getting
getting a great game. You're going to get a game that you're going to be able to play for hours and hours and hours, and you're going to get, it's going to be great. I mean, there's no bones about it. I mean, we're not even hyping this up. Like, we've all played enough Rockstar games at this point that we just know what a Rockstar game means.
I mean, look at Grand Theft Auto 5. Look what they did with Grand Theft Auto Online.
Yeah.
Well, now there's going to be Red Dead Online.
Yeah.
That's going to be a fleshed out online universe to go along with it, which you're getting with the price of the game too.
Yeah.
And God, the story, the cutscenes, the acting, it's worth the investment time, and it's worth the time it takes to put it together. And so they run on 4 to 5 year dev cycles. You can see the quality.
You also see weird little bits of possible continuity that they're going to put in with Mafia 3.
Yeah, that's been kind of speculated, hasn't it?
Yeah, where I guess there's a New Bordeaux, which is the setting of Mafia 3. It's been rumored, or there is, they said that there's a chance that an early version of New Bordeaux is going to turn up in Red Dead 2.
Interesting.
Could be interesting.
So they might tie the various universes together.
Yeah.
In some way between those two, and then wonder if that will ever expand to include the Grand Theft Auto universe.
Yeah, or just some of the cities from Grand Theft Auto. Mm-hmm. Like,
there's enough of them.
Like Old Vash City or something like.
But certainly, I mean, Rockstar Games, they give their teams the time to put it together, and it's not an annual release too, which really helps.
Yeah, it's not like Grand Theft Auto 2K18. Like, no.
It's, no. There's the scarcity of product, which, develops an interest in it. Or unlike, say, the Call of Duty games, where there's one every year, it is expected. And because it's an annual release, the luster of it has been steadily declining year after year.
Yeah.
The luster, the appeal, the general, like, oh, hey, that game's coming. And also the sales have been declining.
Yeah. I mean, Call of Duty has its core audience. Like, I do know some people who always buy the new Call of Duty game every year.
Much like some people always buy the new Madden.
Yeah, but it's like, it's literally just them and their friends treat it like a new map pack is all that they do. It's like, I know people that never play the first person, like they never play the campaign mode because they're literally just want to get the new maps, want to play the new maps with their friends. Want to see what new guns and stuff are in the game, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And that's fine, but, you know, people often move on, and, yeah. But regardless of all this aside, this year's new Call of Duty game is going to be Black Ops 4.
Now, the interesting thing is that has not been officially announced yet.
No.
But Eurogamer has the scoop.
Yeah, and when Eurogamer has the scoop, we normally listen, because they've had, I think, 100% correct, track record.
Off the top of my head, I cannot recall of a scoop that did not come to fruition that Eurogamer had, but their sources are telling them that it's Black Ops 4 for this year's Call of Duty game being developed by Treyarch, which I think would make sense because Activision now has these games on 3-year dev cycles, and the last Black Ops game was, 3 years ago, done by Treyarch. And just, I think either a couple days ago, Activision officially recognized and announced that Treyarch would be making this year's Black Ops game. So it's looking very likely. Other sources and scuttlebutt out there are saying that the game, Black Ops 4, will also come out on the Nintendo Switch, which would be the first Call of Duty game in several years on a Nintendo platform, I think since 2013 on the Wii U. Which no one will remember.
No one will remember that. And, probably few people actually played it, but,
apparently the Switch version will also support, all the DLC, also feature HD rumble, motion controls, all that stuff. So it'll be treated as much as an equal as it possibly can be compared to its, more powerful or its counterparts on more powerful systems.
Yeah. So, you know, last year's Call of Duty did a little bit better than 2 years ago's Call of Duty, which was Infinite Warfare. And I think that was just because they went back to a different setting rather than like trying to keep going crazier and crazier with the future stuff. They just went back to World War II.
Yeah.
Kind of brought it more back to basics, as it were, which a lot of people kind of appreciated. Similar to, you know, Battlefront 1 or Battlefield 1.
Going back to World War 1.
Going back to World War 1, yeah. So, you know.
And that's also the roots of these game series too.
Yeah, like these did start off as like war games in classic war settings. And yeah, I mean, Black Ops kind of continues to push it out further into like the weird, not like modern warfare does, but still. But we'll see where it all goes from here. Yeah.
So that more details when they are officially announced, in terms of release date, you know, a Call of Duty game comes out around Veterans Day / Remembrance Day every year. So look for it then.
Yes. Just, remember to press X to pay respects.
Oh dear God. Yes. But no doubt when it comes out, Call of Duty will be a game that's, streamed by many people out there because game streaming is just a huge field. It has really exploded over the past little bit in no small part because, platforms like Twitch make it much easier to do.
Yeah.
And have developed a very large community. And if you're wanting to get into game streaming or watch a game stream or do anything associated with game streaming, Twitch is likely your top of mind platform to turn to.
Yeah, and it's easy to see why that's been the case. Twitch has been around for several years now. I mean, famous gamers and stuff on Twitter and whatever always have their Twitch accounts, you know, being linked to and whatever else. And, you know, the news cycles always talk about things being streamed on Twitch. Twitch is pretty much top of mind, and I'm sure this must, you know, really grind the gears of various other video content providers, like YouTube, and more recently Facebook, who's been sort of pushing to have video, like, they've been pushing to basically become YouTube too, with, you know, the amount of video content that they're trying to push forward and try to make it as easy for you to just stay on Facebook all the time for everything that you need.
Because there's people who are not spending as much time on Facebook anymore. Well, if we can bring video into it, they'll spend more time on Facebook.
It's like, why do you need to go to YouTube to get that video that you can just get on Facebook? Or why go to Twitch to get those things when Facebook has video streaming as well?
Oh my God. So Facebook announced, at the end of January, again, we're catching up on things, bear with us, but it might be new to you, and if it is, Facebook announced something called the Gaming Creator Pilot Program, which is a live streaming monetization service geared specifically toward, quote, gaming streamers, a.k.a. Facebook Twitch.
Yeah.
That's their
Facebook Live Twitch type thing.
Times Twitch, cross Twitch, or yeah, whatever, but Facebook version of Twitch.
Yeah,
that's it. They're calling this pilot program, or saying that this pilot program is, quote, actively exploring ways for fans to back their favorite gaming creators via payments during select live streams on Facebook. However, further details on that and how fans can support their favorite streamers have not been announced. So the monetization aspect and treating their talent, if you will, of the streamers seems to be a big focus of this, or will be a big focus of this. Other than that, the technical stuff, fairly similar, comparable to others out there. Live stream at 1080p and 60 frames per second. Actually, whereas Facebook Live right now caps out at 720p and 30 frames per second. But it's still in its infancy, and they're, I guess, looking to build it more on a solid foundation. Facebook in the initial press release and blog post saying, quote, based on the results of our initial tests, we'll expand our fan support monetization initiatives to more gaming creators, including participants in our initial pilot program, end quote. So you'll have Facebook version of Twitch to look forward to now.
Yeah.
At this point, I don't know.
It might do well, but I don't know. I have no idea. I don't know how this will go.
I mean, Facebook has the power and money to just make it work.
Yeah.
By sheer force of will.
Yeah. Like, there's things that I remember people, like, every single time Facebook does a major change, there's a huge outcry, but it never changes, and it only kind of gets weirder and weirder, but then people just kind of get used to it, and then that's just Facebook now. So if this just becomes a part of Facebook, I could see it becoming a part of Facebook, and I can see it becoming super normalized. I don't know if I can see it replacing Twitch, but I can just see it being another thing that people just watch video with. So there is that.
And at this point, too, how do you compete with Twitch when the people who are into game streaming, already doing game streaming, watching game streaming, just participating in game streams, turn to Twitch?
Well, Facebook is definitely going to have to make some deals with some of these streamers and pay them to use the service to bring eyeballs over there instead of on Twitch, and hopefully incidentally see other people on Facebook streaming as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing that Facebook can hope to do at this point.
Well, and they do have the benefit of the targeted ads. They would have the metrics and the biographical demographic information of the users on Facebook to know who to try and gear those ads to get them interested and get them watching on this service.
Yeah, all the various kinetic data that people leave throughout Facebook. They have an ungodly amount of information that no other company has ever had, I think, at this point.
Was it you who was mentioning to me before they record like every click and button click and like keyboard stroke?
Yeah. Like I recall reading a thing at some point a few years ago how they basically revealed that they were doing some sort of psychological study kind of on the hush where they saw what people typed and didn't send. Which
is unsettling.
It's unsettling. But also, I'm kind of curious what kind of psychological information they were able to pull out of that. I don't know. But then we start going down this rabbit hole, and then we start wondering, like, how much of reality gets unraveled over the last few years, and how much of crazy influence social media has actually had on our brain patterns and stuff. But regardless, that's a whole other, maybe a whole other podcast that we don't.
I think it would require some people from perhaps academia to walk us through that one.
Yeah. Maybe walk us back from the ledge because that, it's possible to go too far on that topic.
And before we go too far on that topic, let's, turn our attention to turn back time now as we get into our last segment of the program for this week. You've missed it. We've missed it. It's time for the blast from the past, the portion of the show where we take some time to speak about and remind you of some notable pieces of entertainment that you have enjoyed or, heard about, or perhaps they're entirely new to you, but they're celebrating milestone anniversaries. We have three items this week because we couldn't really parse them down to two, but deal with it. Two of them came out on the same date, back in 1978, and the other one is more recent, circa 2003. And they're all music albums too, by the way. So the crazy thing is, again, two of them were released on the exact same date back in 1978. The other one is a more recent album by a mostly Canadian band with some American influence as well. But that one is from 2003. So, Mr. Dennis, I will turn to you now and ask you, where do you wish to start?
Well, we can start with the youngest of the albums first, kind of like dip in a bit.
All right.
Basically, this is just sort of like, I want to say it's three classic metal albums at this point, that we're talking about. But this first one came out 15 years ago. And in my opinion, it was sort of a seminal album, though the brainchild of the project in hindsight now just kind of downplays it, doesn't think it was like that big of a deal, but I love the album. I've been listening to it since it came out. And, it's a band that no longer exists. It's a band whose songs no longer get performed because, the main brainchild, of course, like, puts like all of the lyrics and everything that music in as like a different part of his life, which he's passed at this point, brought out a bunch of bad mental stuff with him, but it's still killer music in my opinion. If you're into like really aggressive, crazy music, Strapping Young Lad was, you've probably heard of them and
you've heard of them on this show.
You've heard of them on this show. We make no bones about the fact that we are Devin Townsend fans on this program. Devin Townsend being the lead vocalist, one of the lead guitar players of Strapping Young Lad, and also just kind of a musical mastermind in his own right, having been, his discography is at this point getting, frankly, a little bit ludicrous.
He's getting into Frank Zappa territory of workaholic.
Yeah.
And music creation.
Just number of things he's done, number of projects he's been involved with, but yeah, this was the third Strapping Young Lad album.
Third of five.
The one that really, in my opinion, is where they kind of cemented themselves and kind of coalesced what Strapping Young Lad was as a band. Previous to that, it was sort of like more just Devin Townsend's crazy, noisy, industrial, metal-y, outrageous throw everything out there that you can possibly think of and make everything stick, you know, like the super dense city, which is probably the best Strapping Young Lad album, but it's still like, it's a very dense listen.
Mm-hmm.
Heavy is a really heavy thing. It was just sort of Devin Townsend figuring out, you know, just letting a bunch of unbridled anger out. Whereas Strapping Young Lad was where, okay, he's writing with a band of super competent metal musicians, and now they're just decided, we are a metal band. Let's just go full on out with this. Take all the best elements of City, crystallize it down into, you know, take all the best metal elements out of it, keep all the aggression and intensity, maybe pare back a little bit of like the crazy sampling and like industrial stuff, and just kind of like, we're just be like the best crazy metal band you can possibly be.
Figured it out.
Yeah, they figured it out. And yeah, Strapping Young Lad's self-titled Strapping Young Lad album, which came out February 11th, 2003. It's an intense listen, but maybe it's not as intimidating a listen as City. Or maybe, I feel like if you are looking at getting into Strapping Young Lad, this is a great entry point. It's a nice balance between, you know, the craziness that, you know, is City, or the craziness for other reasons that is Alien, or like the weirdness and like kind of meandering that the New Black does in a similar way that Heavy is a Really Heavy Thing kind of does as well. It's a good, I think it's the most even Strapping Young Lad album in many ways, if that makes any sort of sense.
And yet you can also hear a lot of Devin Townsend on the album too, and
well, no more than any other Strapping Young Lad album, I think, or any other Devin Townsend album, but it's sort of like where he sort of like started reconciling his softer side with his heavy side while keeping all of the intensity of both, just kind of all shooting it all together.
And the softer side is kind of what I was trying to get at there, but yeah, didn't articulate too terribly well, because the softer side is he loves at times like a full sound, but mixed with a lot of heavy elements.
Yeah.
And you get parts of that on this album, and that's the softer side comes through on later Devin Townsend project work, and then...
Well, also, like, really just on his solo albums as well. Like,
yeah,
an album previous to this one, if you look at the Wikipedia chronology, for Devin Townsend, the album just previous to this one was Teria, which is probably my favorite album out of anything that he did, Strapping Young Lad included. But, yeah, I was fortunate enough to first see Strapping Young Lad on, in 2003, just after this album came out, I saw the Devin Townsend Band open where he was playing stuff from Teria. I saw Zimmer's Hole play. And that's a whole other experience that we don't need to get into right now, but it's basically lots of Strapping Young Lad is in this other band called Zimmer's Hole. They're silly. Their lead singer dresses up like the devil, whatever else. Then I saw Strapping Young Lad, and they just brought the house down. It was ridiculous. And it was that night when I'm like, okay, Devin Townsend is probably my favorite musician. Then, done. Ever since then, it's just been kind of like solidified. I saw Strapping Young Lad twice more, and then they sadly broke up, and now Devin Townsend just doesn't play Strapping Young Lad music anymore because it puts him in a bad headspace, which I can respect, but it still makes me sad. But glad that I got to see them live a couple times.
Makes you appreciate it that much more.
Absolutely.
So, Strapping Young Lad, if you're looking for something that's on the heavier side, check out their 2003 album, as it has turned 15 years old this week. But let's go even further back. As I mentioned, we have two albums from 1978 released on the very same day. We love when those moments come up. But one was the debut album that is one of the best debut albums for a band ever.
Actually, before we talk about that one, we can talk about another metal classic that also vaguely ties into Strapping Young Lad. Strapping Young Lad actually covered the first song on this album.
Did they?
Yes, they covered Judas Priest's Exciter. Did a really awesome version as well, which, you know, if you ever doubted Devin Townsend's vocal prowess, he's right up there with Rob Halford. Maybe even more maybe even better than Rob Halford, which might be blasphemy to say as a metal fan, because Rob Halford's incredible.
Yes, he's a god.
Yeah. But regardless, yeah, Exciter was like kind of like a high energy, hard rocking double kick in like filled early proto power metal song from Judas Priest that started off their classic 1978 album Stained Class,
which came out on February 10th of 1978. So it's up getting up there in age.
Yeah. But, yeah, it was one of three albums that they did with, well, I'd say up until they got Scott Travis, their best drummer, Les Binks, you know, including, you know, Stained Class, Killing Machine, and then, yeah, I got Unleashed in the East, whatever else. Yeah, it's just, it's a classic album. Like it's got a lot. I mean, I don't know what to say about Judas Priest albums. Like it's sort of like if you've heard one, you've heard them all, but that doesn't mean they're bad.
No,
it just means they're consistent and, but they're not all the same, which is like weird because like Judas Priest is one of those bands that sort of shifts with the times, but still maintains all their best core elements.
Mm-hmm.
And they just kind of like expand what they do. Stained Class was sort of expanding what they did a bit, you know, like going just from more blues stuff to kind of more hard driving metal stuff. Right after Sin After Sin, which was also very metal.
And between the, I guess, mid to late 70s and into the early 80s, Judas Priest put out a lot of music.
Yeah, a ton of music.
Like, they were cranking them out. Yeah. Cranking out the albums.
Yeah, like, 76, it all sort of started off with Sad Wings of Destiny, 77, Sin After Sin, 78, then they put out Stained Class, 78, they also put out Killing Machine, which, you know, we knew as Hellbent for Leather in the US for various reasons. Then in 79, Unleashed in the East and British Steel in 1980. So like within the span of like 3 years, they put out like five albums. Like that's crazy.
That's a ridiculous cycle.
Yeah. But yeah, Stained Class.
And this is also the album that led to the Better By You, Better Than Me controversy. Lawsuit that they were slapped with in the late 80s / early 90s, when they were accused of having subliminal lyrics in the song.
Yeah, claiming that there was backmasking in the music and like when you played it backwards, it was just, you could hear, you know, the suggestion that you should kill yourself. You should just do it. And Judas Priest was like, this is ridiculous. What the hell are you talking about? They played it in court. Like they had to have experts come in and like analyze. Oh, do you hear it there? They were like, ultimately they were ruled that no, they didn't have that in there and there was nothing intentional.
I think it was a civil lawsuit that was brought forward by the, parents and family of a young teenage boy in the United States who apparently had been listening to this album and, then ultimately and unfortunately took his own life. And
yeah.
The parents held this band and this song as being responsible for why the son ultimately took his own life.
Which is ridiculous, but, I mean, obviously, not to downplay, you know, the pain and anguish that the parents of this child was feeling, but they needed someone to blame because obviously it's just an unthinkable thing, but it's not fair to blame anyone for something like this, let alone a band like Judas Priest who just wants to put out music to entertain people.
It's true.
For it to come back to them in such a horrifying way is just completely unfair.
It was, and I recall watching, I guess, a part of the Behind the Music episode from VH1 on Judas Priest, and they covered this and showed the clip of Rob Halford taking the stand in court and when it was put to him that the, you know, there was this subliminal lyric, you know, saying, do it. And his response was to simply say, do what?
Yeah.
Like, how can this come back at us?
Yeah.
It's unfortunate, but that is part of the album's legacy. But it also has the ability to say it came out on the same day as one of the greatest debut albums ever from any band.
Yeah.
You might think that's a bold and ostentatious claim, but...
Well, let's just list some songs here. Running with the Devil, Eruption, You Really Got Me, Ain't Talking About Love, Jamie's Crying. Think about all of that for a second. You're actually thinking, okay, what are you, listing Van Halen's greatest hits? No, we're listing several songs off of Van Halen's first album.
That entire first side was what starts with Running with the Devil,
Eruption, You Really Got Me, Ain't Talking About Love. The first four songs. Like, how can a band have a debut album that is that in the first four songs? I mean, then there's I'm the One, closing out the side one, then side two, Jamie's Crying, Atomic Punk, Feel Your Love Tonight, Little Dreamer, Ice Cream Man on Fire. Not Ice Cream Man on Fire, but the Ice Cream Man, space, next song, on fire.
So, yeah, that's the thing that happened. That's an album. You would think those are like, well, those are some of the greatest hits of Van Halen's career. That's what they started with.
Yeah. They're all on the first album. That's insane.
They're all on the first side of the first album.
Yeah.
Like, it's not, that's what you start with. This is when you just blew people's minds away and just probably blew a lot of speakers, a lot of car stereos.
Eddie Van Halen changed rock guitar mm-hmm. in the same way that Jimi Hendrix changed rock guitar. I mean, say whatever you want about other guitar players, but none of them had the impact that those two guys had. And Eddie Van Halen is one of the two guys.
Yeah.
Like every guitar player has that moment when they hear Eruption for the first time and go, holy crap.
This is what I'm competing with. This is what's out there in the world.
I mean, like, it gets maybe a little bit watered down as time goes by, as, you know, more people have more impressive chops. But remember, in 1978, people weren't doing, like, 80s shred guitar yet. Because 80s shred guitar was not an established trope. It took Eddie Van Halen to say, you know what, guitar can be insane and flashy and ridiculous. Let's do that. And I know, like, there's always debates online and stuff, you know, Eddie Van Halen never once claimed that he invented the two-handed tapping style, but he certainly made it popular. And yeah, you can cite your weird 1960s Italian black and white video of some guy playing an acoustic guitar doing two-handed tapping, but that's not what, you know, kids got excited about. That's not what, you know, that's not what Marty McFly was referencing in Back to the Future when he, like, you know, started going crazy on the guitar for the, you know, the Chuck Berry mm-hmm. band or whatever. No, nothing like that.
He inspired an entire generation of kids to pick up the guitar.
Yeah.
And probably some adults at the time to put it down.
Absolutely.
He crushed a lot of people's dreams back then.
Yeah. Eddie Van Halen.
Cause they were still young at the time. We might only think of Van Halen just being, you know, the old time, classic rock radio act they are now. They were young whippersnappers back then.
Yeah. Like that was 40 years ago. Eddie Van Halen would have been 23. To be 23 and change the face of rock guitar. Like, that's insane. And like, Van Halen really didn't like peter out, fizzle out for quite some time. You'd think that after putting out a release, like a debut that has so many like now classic songs on it, you'd think, well, they couldn't possibly have much more gas in the tank after that.
Well, it's a valid question too with something like that to where do you go from there?
But they still managed to somehow keep it going. Van Halen 2 was later on, like they had like, you know, Dance the Night Away, you know, Somebody Get Me a Doctor, you know, Spanish Fly, another crazy guitar song, Beautiful Girls, which I always think of with, you know, from, you know, SNL, that Schmitz Gay Beer commercial. But yeah, like setting them up for like a really pretty long and classic career. And then later on with like weird drama with between Eddie Van Halen and or like the Van Halens and David Lee Roth bringing mm-hmm. in Sammy Hagar and whatever else. But yeah, regardless, it all started off on the first Van Halen album. And if you've never heard it in its entirety, it's worth doing. It's an incredible album from like start to finish.
You've literally heard half the songs by now just on radio.
Yeah. And if you didn't realize they were all on the same album and all on the first Van Halen album, it must be mind-blowing to you. It was mind-blowing to me when I first learned that, and I heard the whole album. I was like, holy crap, this album's crazy.
Now, granted, we're looking back on this album with the hindsight of 40 years. If you're there in it in the moment, you don't know that this is necessarily going to change everything right away.
No, no one ever knows that whatever they're seeing, that's whatever revolutionary thing they're seeing is revolutionary. Like, revolutionary status comes with hindsight and stuff, like Star Wars or
Star Trek
or, you know, whatever else. But Van Halen is definitely one of those things. And yeah, like, if you're not really into metal and you're tired of us just, you know, always suggesting crazy albums to you, this is probably one of the less crazy albums in terms of like intensity or whatever else that we're going to suggest to you.
Mm-hmm.
But it's crazy just for you to think how many now classic rock songs are on this album.
Quality, craftsmanship, guitar ability.
Yeah. Well, everything ability, really. Like, I mean, Alex Van Halen's no slouch on the drums. David Lee Roth is one of the best frontmen of all time. I'll just go on record for saying that.
True.
Like you love him or hate him, you remember him.
True. David Lee Roth and Eddie Van Halen really formed the new Page and Plant.
Yeah.
With this album.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Just and, for a new generation, you know.
Yeah, and like the tightness of brothers in bands as well, like they really kind of brought that forward because like, you know, you don't, like anytime you see like two solid brother musicians, like they've been playing together forever, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the fact that they were 23, 26, whatever years old on this album together, didn't matter. They've been playing together for years. So
wasn't there a story where Frank Zappa was instead of teaching Dweezil Zappa how to play guitar, he just told him to like go see Eddie Van Halen?
No, what it was like I remember reading this in the I think it was Guitar Player magazine where they were doing an interview with Eddie Van Halen before, because him and Dweezil are friends,
mm-hmm.
and the whole reason why they became friends was because at some point in some interview, someone asked Frank Zappa who he finds interesting as a musician these days. And, you know, he mentioned, I think, Alan Holdsworth and, or just for guitar players, I think he mentioned like Alan Holdsworth, might not have been Alan Holdsworth, but he was saying something like to the effect of Eddie Van Halen, that guy's taking rock guitar to a new planet kind of thing. Or it's like, he's one of the most interesting guitar guys on the planet right now. And then Eddie Van Halen was just like, I have to meet Frank Zappa now, because that's just the kind of person Eddie Van Halen is. It's like, I want to shake that man's hand kind of thing. Like, it's like, okay. And then he apparently just randomly just figured out where, I don't know exactly how he figured out who he was. Maybe he might have looked up his phone number and called him up, and then he showed up with his guitar one day. And then like Frank Zappa apparently answered the door and was like, hello. And then Dweezil was like, oh my God, Eddie Van Halen's at the door. And then it was like, yeah, that's like one of like the great ridiculous classic stories there. It's like, okay.
All because this album launched him into the stratosphere of rock.
Yeah. And like, yeah, for a while, apparently, too, like, he was super protective of his playing technique that, like, David Lee Roth basically told him, oh, anytime you do that crazy tapping stuff, turn away from the, you know, just turn away from the stage and just, or, like, don't face people and just kind of, like, don't let them see what you're doing. Don't give away the secret. Which I don't know how, if he actually did that or not, but whatever, but, yeah.
Well, I could imagine for the first bit after this album was wowing people and playing it on stage, on tour, it'd certainly keep some of the mystery up and, like, make people wonder, what the hell is he doing on stage? But this music is still coming out.
Yeah.
So, but Van Halen, the debut album, came out February 10th, 1978, making it goddamn old, 40 years. But that was the same day Judas Priest's fourth album, Stained Class, came out. And then many years after that, on February 11th, 2003, if you're wanting something a bit more aggressive, but it's a fairly aggressive suite of albums this week.
Yeah.
Strapping Young Lad's self-titled third album came out on February 11th, 2003. Those are the three ridiculous rock metal albums we have celebrating milestone anniversaries for you this week, which also brings us to the tail end of this week's program. We thank you so much for joining us and certainly want to hear your thoughts on those albums. Did Van Halen's debut album get you into guitar? Or perhaps if you're of a certain age, did it get you out of guitar? Let us know your thoughts as well as anything else you heard on this program. You can email us info@thearcadeshow.com. You can also send us a message and follow us on Twitter @thearcadeshow and like our page on Facebook, facebook.com/thearcadeshow. Links to both of those located right there on our homepage, thearcadeshow.com, where you can also find direct links to our pages on both iTunes and the Google Play Podcast Store. And we thank you so much for joining us, and well, we shall wait for you to join us again next week as we shall return in a week's time hence. So until then, good night, everybody.
Good night.
Thank you.